The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN+.
Welcome to Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, creative advisor for the Second City. We are brought to you by Second City Works, which is the B2B arm of the world-famous Second City Theater. You can find us at secondcityworks.com. And this is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and your life. The term yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It's at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and making discoveries together. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Joshua Wolfschenk. Josh is the author of Powers of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs, a critically acclaimed book published in 2014. His first book was Lincoln's Melancholy, which won a number of awards. His writing has been seen in The Atlantic, Harper's, and The New Yorker. He is a founding advisor to The Moth, where he helped develop The Moth Radio Hour. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So there's so much in your Powers of Two book that connects to the themes that we discuss on a regular basis during this podcast, but I thought I might start our conversation by getting an idea on what might have drawn you to write about the creativity of dyads. And I found a passage from your writing on Abraham Lincoln that seemed important, so I'm going to quote you. You wrote, "Viewing Lincoln through the lens of his melancholy, we see one cogent explanation. He was always inclined to look at the full truth of a situation, assessing both what could be known and what remained in doubt. When faced with uncertainty, he had the patience, endurance, and vigor to stay in that place of tension and the courage to be alone." So is there something about that sort of like aloneness that might have led you to go in this other direction and look at the twos?
Yeah, that's incisive that you would draw a connection between those two subjects and projects. There's certainly, you know, I wrote about depression because it's a big part of my life experience, my family's experience, and coming out of depression, you know, one looks at engaging with the world, hanging on to a common reality, and you know, I think I've always implicitly been governed by the ideas of Martin Buber, even before I really knew who Buber was or what he. How he framed his philosophy, but you know, Buber, it's a very Jewish view that you know our relationships really are everything. That's God. That's you know that sort of full total reality. And you know that understanding them, working with them, you know, appreciating their fruits is. You know, and recognizing, learning to live with their difficulties is sort of our highest aim. This wasn't on my mind when I thought about the project to begin with, but I'm sure it was operating on my unconscious. The thing that was operating on my conscious mind was that I always like to follow subjects where there's some huge critical question that feels like it has relevance to a lot of people. You know, in the world, and it also is just kind of burning in my own heart, and that this question of interpersonal chemistry, so to speak, you know, what is it, and where does it come from, and how does it play out, and you know, what was going on between John Lennon and Paul McCartney, and can you write a kind of biography of a relationship? These things really energize me. And when I started to look at it, I thought, well, you know, a way to limit this huge question about social kind of connections and influence, which is really staggering, you know, when you start to follow one step after the other, you very quickly get to this place of like, well, you know, is there such a thing as originality? You know, are we all just on a sort of endless chain of influence? Mm-hmm. And I thought one way to kind of to bind that up would be to look at two people and look at the sort of the smallest social unit, which is a dyadic relationship. And that's how I came to that mode. I have to say, in the years that have followed, you know, I'm not sure about that decision, because social dynamics in the real world, you know, play out in twos, they play out in threes, they play out in small groups. Mm-hmm. And these questions of chemistry are not limited to pairs. I thought when I wrote the book that people would immediately understand that this was a kind of thought experiment, right. And many smart readers do, but the book, I think, was received a little bit in this simple way of like, well, two's better than one, and, you know, two's better than three.
Right, and that's it.
And I never meant to assert the primacy of the dyad in that kind of way. And I actually, as a creative person, one of the things that I find most interesting is the movement between solitude and connection as a kind of, this is sort of the tidal flow of a creative life. Mm-hmm. And in the same way that you would never say, you know, to the oceans, well, make up your mind, the tide should be in or out. You would never say to a creative person, make up your mind whether to be solitary or whether to be engaged. And in fact, one of the reasons why dyads are such an interesting group is that they allow for that movement in an extremely fluid and subtle way. Mm-hmm. That you can simply have a moment of silence when you are alone with one other person and be solitary. You're not leaving that relationship by, you know, having a bit of space. Whereas the moment you add a third or fourth person to the room, silence has a whole other quality.
Right.
Coming back to your question, it's, you know, just a fascination with these questions of chemistry and relationship. And yeah, it's certainly, yeah, connected to depression as a kind of, 180 degree.
Yeah.
That's something 180 degrees from it.
Right. Two thoughts, just riffing on what you just said. We talked on this podcast to the Reverend Dr. Samuel Wells, who is the vicar of St. Martin in the Fields. He wrote a book on improvisation like 12 years ago, and it's become sort of a guiding principle for him. And one of the things that he said in our talk was that the number one problem in the human condition used to be mortality. And when we seem to have figured out that pretty well, and he suggested in our conversation that the number one problem now is isolation. And so interesting you bring up Buber, and then, you know, this is someone working from, you know, the Anglican Church, but finding a very similar problem. And then, you know, our work at Second City, which is primarily in ensembles of six. And I was talking to my wife about this, who's a longtime Second City director and teacher. And we sort of said, yeah, even though it is a group of six, almost invariably the writing gets split up in pairs.
Yeah.
You know, that just
happens. That's a very common dynamic. It's you see that in Hollywood, you know, which is immensely social environment, driven by pairs. Monty Python worked that way.
Mm-hmm.
And there is something very special about that, what happens between two people, and it is often overlooked. We tend to look at the Beatles or John.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the kind of cliche is this argument between the great man theory of history and the sort of, no, it's social context. I mean, I remember very distinctly hearing that dialectic laid out in my high school history class.
Hmm.
You know, was it John Adams and Thomas Jefferson? Were these men geniuses, or were they simply, you know, reasonably bright guys at a time when these Enlightenment ideas were bubbling up to the point where it was almost inevitable that they would find some kind of, you know, public expression? But you know, I don't remember anyone ever saying, well, you know, what was that relationship like between Jefferson and Adams? And can we look at the combination of alliance and competition and admiration and enmity and all the sort of messy things that happen? And one of the reasons we don't do that is because it is extremely messy, and it becomes very hot emotionally very quickly, both for the objects of that kind of inquiry and for the people who are doing the inquiring. And so what you see in, you know, the business literature, where a lot of the creativity stuff is really anchored, because that's where the big money is to be made,
mm-hmm.
Is this, you know, they're looking at teams and systems and things that sort of seem cool and clear, and you know, there can be this very neat 5-point plan, mm-hmm. and there can be some kind of chart, and they're very uncomfortable with talk about relationships.
Right.
I underestimated that blowback when I was writing the book, and I thought, well, you know, let's if I make this overwhelming case, you know, people will really kind of look at this with their eyes wide open. And I saw, you know, it was really kind of the edges of the business world that were looking at this subject, and a lot of them just said, yeah, we're pretty cool to the topic,
mm-hmm.
And just don't want, you know, there's a sort of response, you know, we don't want to get into the realm of couples therapy. And, you know, it's kind of preposterous if you just think about what are people doing at work all day. They're thinking about their relationships.
Yes.
And how's it going? And how do I work with this person who is, my deputy or my employee? And how do I work with my boss? And what's going on with the guy down the hall? It occupies, you know, in an overwhelming amount of the sort of our mental real estate when it comes to any kind of work, and certainly creative work. But it's sort of excised from public conversation. And, you know, one of the things that was really disheartening to see is just how little is actually on the record, because, you know, what happens in our most intimate relationships is often something we don't want to share.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, very often you'll see one half or an entirety of a correspondence entirely obliterated in the historical record. You know, people just, has Art Garfunkel ever really talked about what happened between him and Paul Simon? He has not.
No.
And he's actually said that he hasn't.
Mm-hmm.
He's, you know, he said, you know, if the full story is ever told, people are going to be really surprised, but he hasn't told the full story.
Mm-mm.
And if, you know, if he, leaves us before he does, we won't have access to it. And so the history won't take account of it.
It's funny. You talk about quite rightly that business is uncomfortable with intimacy, yet every brand is craving authenticity. And you don't get one without the other. And that sort of also speaks to this idea that you talk about, and I think you use the term promising discomfort. And in our work, in improvisational work, that's very much about like using mistakes and being okay with looking foolish and failing rapidly. And I think in terms of what you're talking about is, you know, no great creative act ever came from everyone just sort of feeling the same with an equal dynamic without any difficulty around them. And in fact, the great work seems to emanate from this really sort of unevenness that these pairs, because they come together, find a way to work through.
Yeah. Yeah, that discomfort, I mean, it, you know, we can experience, that's part of a solitary practice too. You know, being able to sit with not knowing, you know, creating something that you know is sort of sucky. It's a lot easier to control that discomfort in solitary practice, and to work through it with, you know, certain constraints and limits, like, you know, we'll just sit in the chair for 3 hours or just produce, you know,
mm-hmm.
800 words. I'm speaking as a literary writer here because that's what I know best.
Yeah.
When another person's in the room, you know, it gets a lot hotter. You know, you feel excited, you feel angry. The emotions are flying in a way that the discomfort, I think, takes a lot more sophistication to manage. And when you look at the real genius of someone like John Lennon, I think it is that he managed that discomfort really, really well for a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
And when he left Paul, number one, it was never intended to be permanent. But number two, you know, he was very clear about leaving that active collaboration for another active collaboration with Yoko Ono.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, this was a guy who, you know, always knew that he was going to need to be drawn out, you know, by these partners who he was also very clear were very difficult people, who were very challenging and provocative, and it roiled up his mind. And so, you know, how do you develop that capacity? And this is something I think about a lot now, because I came off the book into a big job running a literary center. And so I have these, you know, daily relationships in a way that I haven't had before. I always had editors and agents and, you know, colleagues and whatnot, but I haven't had an assistant and a deputy and, you know, a staff and the sort of whole mesh of colleagues that sort of day in, day out. And the patience and the sort of long vision and the, you know, wanting to sort of manage this balance between, you know, keeping things civil and cool and warm on the one hand. On the other hand, inviting dissension, inviting conflict, because you can't have creativity without it.
Right. Which kind of leads a little bit to the stuff you write about around power, which was unexpected. I did not expect for you to go into this area, because you, and a great quote you have is, power is to relationships what gravity is to matter.
Right.
And I don't that doesn't seem like a, that seems counterintuitive, but it isn't when you give it some thought.
Yeah, this is something I also still playing out in my mind. There's this great democratic dream that is, you know, of relationships that is quite out of step with actual practice. And I think actually doing us a lot of harm and is relevant to the political situation, because the idealistic account of relationships does not fit with actual practice. And that chasm, you know, is something that people are kind of falling into and really getting hurt by. And, you know, as a simple practical matter, you know, intimacy is actually really facilitated by a certain amount of clarity around power dynamic. And we should not shy away from that. And we should not, you know, the word collaboration is actually a really, really problematic word when you're looking at creative intimacy, because it suggests, okay, two relatively equal people, you know, having these exchanges and this kind of like environment of parity. And, you know, people will say, well, I don't collaborate because, you know, I'm a literary writer and I only talk to my editor once every 6 months, or, you know, I'm running this huge enterprise and this person who works for me is, you know, my employee and I could fire him or her. So that's not collaboration. But in the first instance, you know, it has to do with the dance between, you know, actual sort of live connection, talking to someone, and solitude. In the second instance, it has to do with power. And that, you know, really, really powerful people, actually, that's one of the first relationships you should look at, is who is answering their mail, scheduling their calls, running their schedule. You know, every kind of, you know, person at the top of a big institution has someone like that. Mm-hmm. And people who are doing really well have someone who is essentially running their life.
Yep.
And there's another situation where, you know, we should get comfortable with the discomfort, because it's not easy to expose yourself in an environment where you are, where you are on the sort of subordinate end of a power dynamic, but you have to do that. And it's also not easy for the person who is sort of in the dominant position to sort of invite the vulnerability of being challenged, but you have to do that too. John Lennon, as with all these things, Lennon and McCartney are kind of this perfect, you know, case study, because they light up all these themes. Mm-hmm. But John Lennon was this overwhelming alpha who just exuded a certain kind of, you know, charm, charisma, energy that people naturally deferred to. But he succeeded because he invited people around him to kind of step up and play with him in a really aggressive way. Mm-hmm. And that was, yeah, it was an enormously generative dynamic, albeit a really combustible one, and super common.
Yeah, yeah. The parallel in our world is a process, an improvisational process, which is very ensemble-oriented, very group-oriented, make your partner look good.
Right.
And, however, what is Second City known for? Producing stars. Left and right.
Right.
Been doing it since 1959. And when you talk about Kahneman's work, this is the thing that I think is unique to improvisers within some of the stuff you're talking about, because they are forced to, in the moment, rapidly switch between their two systems and their brains.
Right.
Complete deference. And in the next moment, you know, they are actually the writers of the script by themselves.
Right.
And it's that sort of mental exercise, I think, is unique to artists who improvise, because I think you do see it in certain kinds of rap and hip hop, and you see it in improvised dance with ensembles. But improv is such a baby art form, right? There's so little study out there, as opposed to the things that you're drawing on, because you talk about Gilbert and Sullivan. I mean, you're going back to collaborations that have spanned the test of time. But I really did. I thought it was unique. There's an improv term called follow the follower, which in essence is about trading off status.
Right. And, you know, some of these ideas are so complicated. It was an enormous struggle to understand them and an even greater one to represent them. And they're still playing out in my mind. I think that the essential image of power is not in the book. And it kind of came to me that it really is a kind of dance where there's a trade-off of leading and learning how to do that dance and recognizing that at any one moment someone will be leading.
Mm-hmm.
is the critical thing.
Yep, totally. So I want to ask you also, because you talk about the audience, and I think one of the things that's unique to live performed comedy is it actually can't be created without the audience, because you don't know if it's funny,
sure,
if they're not laughing. But you rightly say that the presence of an audience can dramatically change creatives, because they get into that sort of self-censor thing. And I love this. You quote a psychologist named Feist, who says, a key element to creativity is to separate idea generation from evaluation and elaboration. That's a pretty unique concept, I think, for a lot of people. But I think some of the science that we see backs that up, that the part of the brain that self-censors appears to be the one that goes down when people are pursuing the creative act.
Yeah. Well, definitely, you know, one of the things that pairs do, and it's definitional, is they shut the door, they leave the world behind, they're there to make the other guy laugh, or, you know, impress the other guy or the other woman with a song or, you know, any kind of piece. I also think that when you look at, you know, stand-up, for instance, there is a kind of dyadic relationship there between, you know, the person with the mic and the audience.
Totally.
And there is a kind of,
mm-hmm,
that back and forth. There's another place where, you know, power dynamics are super interesting, you know, the language in comedy around killing the audience and
yes,
all this aggressive imagery.
Uh-huh.
And the very real way in which, you know, audience is turning on a performer, you know, have pretty grave emotional consequences. Anyway,
No. You're on to something, because, I mean, this is also the difference between improvisational artists and stand-up artists. The stand-ups are lone wolves, generally pretty unhappy bunch. They would all say that.
Yes.
Whereas the improvisational artists, because they are surrounded by fellow players, tend to have a greater ability, certainly in recent era, to sort of go, you know, make it through. You know, and when I say recent era, I think we all know the old Second City stories of the John Belushis and, you know, others who had Chris Farley's, who had a rough time. But frankly, you know, Colbert, Tina Fey, Keegan-Michael Key, Steve Carell, all these people that I worked with are tremendously present partners and collaborators.
Yeah.
And
I'm sure in each of those cases, mm-hmm, there's a story of multiple relationships that are essential to watching their rise and their, you know, and their flourishing. And I'm also sure that if you were to follow all the cases of self-destruction, so-called, you would see a failure of you know, relational holding.
Yeah.
Certainly with Andy Kaufman, that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a guy who just there was no one to hold him. He did have people he worked with,
mm-hmm.
but his primary partner seemed to be someone who kind of amplified his his extremely exciting dysfunction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as opposed to relationships where there's some element of balance. I mean, the Trey Parker Matt Stone relationship is an absolute embodiment, and that's a very rare one,
mm-hmm.
because 99 times out of 100, or 99 gazillion times out of 100 gazillion, there would be the Trey guy is not going to acknowledge the Matt type in public.
Hmm.
It's truly gobsmacking how those guys have managed to create at an extremely high level for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And it owes to the relationship, and it owes to the way they take care of each other. And I'm sure in all those cases you routed off, although I don't know them, that's sort of part of the point. It's a huge part of the point that I don't know anything about those relationships. I did, when I was just starting this project, talk briefly to Conan O'Brien, and he and I were doing a program together, and I said, I'm starting this book, and what do you think of it? And he went right into, he was very passionate about it, and a lot of his passion was just it's so little discussed, and he was talking about The Simpsons and the group dynamics, but also the dynamic between Sam Simon and Matt Groening.
Mm-hmm.
Which, he was really bummed out, had been edged out of the official history of The Simpsons.
Hmm.
I think, and you obviously, you're sort of at the epicenter of this, and, one thing that I appreciate your interest in the book, and I also want to encourage everyone to sort of take this up and to celebrate these relationships, talk about these relationships, acknowledge them, and especially to help young people who are coming up get that this is the reality, because, when they're looking at documentary film, when they're reading biographies, watching award shows, they are going to get this myth of the lone genius. It's just, it's the air we breathe as a creative culture. And you have to work really hard against it to give people a fighting chance. Because if they don't get that education, they're really doomed. A lot of people have that kind of social sense intuitively. I never did, and that's part of the reason why I was driven to write this book, that I had very naively missed how important this is. And I kind of needed to spend 5 years just educating myself on this as a core kind of fundamental reality.
Yeah. I mean, I have a lot of hope for the young people who come in and take our classes. So our training center in Chicago alone has got over 3,000 students who are all embarked in this group creativity. And when you're young, you take to it actually quite easily. I think it's as you get older that it becomes increasingly shut down. And there's one other aspect I did want to pick your brain on before we wrap up. You say, and I quote you, "I didn't go looking for distances in pairs, but it struck me over and over again that without separation, there can be no relation."
Yeah.
This idea of distance is huge in our work, right?
Yes.
But it's more than tragedy plus time is comedy kind of thing. I think what you're talking about is managing all kinds of distances, perceived and imagined, relational,
yes.
Right? I mean, it's a lot of different kind of distance.
Yeah, it is. I don't mean to sound like a broken record, but I'll just invoke Lennon McCartney again, because it's really illustrative of the mistake we made. When did they break up? The answer is they never did.
Hmm.
There was never a moment when those guys said, "We're done with each other." If they did, it was clearly bluster, and they practically the next day corrected it.
Hmm.
It was very clear that it got too hot, it got too intense. There's sort of seismic changes in each man's life and in the life of the band, and there was this kind of moving apart. And they, you know, they were to like two kind of, you know, a moon and a planet who were still very much in a kind of gravitational relationship with one another. And it was simply, you know, a matter of circumstance, you know, the final one being John Lennon's tragic death that kept them from actually ever working from one another. And so you're very right that it's, you know, distance can take a lot of forms. I mean, one way that people get distance from each other is by pissing each other off so that, you know, one storms out of the room.
Sure.
You know, another way is, you know, when, you know, other forces intervene and sort of, you know, people are drawn into other projects and whatnot. And multiple relationships are always operating at the same time. It's not like any one person is going to be your entire universe for all but, you know, a very, very small number of people. And so, yeah, learning to tolerate that and to accept that that is the rhythm of life and it's the rhythm of creativity, to have this sort of moving apart and coming together and to learn, you know, the rhythm of that and to be able to play off the optimal rhythms of how, you know, any two people do really well together. It's very easy to get jealous and to feel lonely and to have all kinds of negative feelings and to think that that is somehow, you know, contravening or contradicting of a kind of primal creative intimacy, when in fact, when you look at these highly effective pairs, they all have, you know, they've all worked out this, what I call optimal distance. And it's, you know, it can be as little as, you know, occasional moments of quiet for people who, you know, are just constantly at each other's side. And it could be as much as working across continents, which some creative pairs do. They need that much space. And of course, you know, time is another form of space. Mm-hmm. And it's, you can embrace it as an opportunity to, you know, identify what's optimal for you.
It's interesting as you're talking, and I'm thinking about how the business world misses this stuff. In part, one of the reasons the artists make such a great example of this kind of work is because they have practice together. They practice the idea of working together and collaborating together. And we don't give even our creatives inside our businesses any place to practice. And then we expect them to foster all these fantastic relationships. You're like, how? In what world does that exist where people working at the highest level of their skill set, you know, the Chicago Cubs, like, not practicing, you know, before to go out the field? You would never say don't do that. Yet, you know, these businesses that are huge operations responsible for a lot of very important work don't give their talent practice. And it's hard. You know, building and working in these relationships, and you have so many amazing stories that are rooted in the business world, but in artists and all across the board that recognize that there's really sort of intrinsic, interesting things at play that have been unstudied.
Yeah, I love the way you're thinking about it, and I love that you're, you know, also looking at this as sort of a, you know, an environment of pedagogy,
yeah,
and instruction, and you know, that I'll just say amen. I mean, let's acknowledge that this is the, you know, that this is where we will be made or broken.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is through the sort of interaction of whatever our internal experiences and the social experience. That's literally how our minds are made to begin with, is this sort of interaction of sort of this, you know, biological infrastructure and the social inputs, and that revolving, you know, ideally in a kind of widening gyre for people who become more expansive and more mature and, you know, and more capable over their lifespans, is, you know, is quite the same as creativity. And so leave it space, you know, do all the things that you would do in any art form, and practice is certainly key. And all these people I'm talking about, you know, they have their joint rituals, they have, they, we're talking about space in the sense of what, you know, the way that people move away and toward each other as a central part of a relationship. But there's also sort of the space around a social dynamic, and the way that, you know, you have a troop of people, you know, close the doors to the theater and really own that space and feel safe and protected there. And the way that, you know, people who work together one-on-one will have a room, either literally or metaphorically, that no one else can enter, and feeling safe with one another in that space and feeling a sense of kind of openness. And, you know, it's like, it's rarely rushed. I mean, you would never give yourself 10 minutes, you know, to write a poem. You have to leave space for your mind to become quiet, for unexpected things to happen. And it's the same with working with someone. You need to, you know, you need to draw a pretty wide circle around that experience. And repetition, a lot of what practice is just repetition, you know, running the same drills, you know, doing these same things over and over again, starting around the same time, you know, or, you know, meeting in the same season, like, you know, when teams come together for spring training. Yeah, so it's all kind of elemental, right? I mean, it's like...
Right. It's building block.
And this was actually one of the weird challenges of writing this book, is I was sort of moved between these extremely abstract, you know, concepts, and I would often sort of like wrest them out of the maw and sort of pull them back. And then what I was holding in my hand also looked like it was so obvious that it would just be a truism.
Mm-hmm.
And so how to then, you know, say it in a way that really captures the majesty while also acknowledging that, yeah, that's actually pretty simple stuff that, you know, that a lot of people just, you know, naturally do well, and including a lot of, you know, great creative stars that we so admire, just that, you know, they somehow just kind of got that knack fairly early on. You gotta bring someone else along for the ride. That is the ride, is you know, what you do with someone else.
Yeah, we keep saying in our office, because one of our divisions works with corporate clients to bring improvisational practices, and we just keep saying it's behaviors and environments. So, are you in an environment where people can speak truth to power? Okay, no, then that's one problem. Are people supporting each other and collaborating? Okay, no, and because when you have those kinds of things nicely set, if you have powerful work to be done, it's going to get done well, and actually, it's going to be done in abundance, because that is another thing I think that a lot of the people that you profile create a massive amount of work whose ratio of good to bad was really, really, you know, the percentage was fantastic, which is an unusual thing. We're coming to the end of our time together, and one of the ways we end this podcast is we ask our guest if they had a moment in their life where they yes-anded, where, you know, typically we say no most of the time. It's our default behavior is to do nothing, which is a kind of no. But
sure.
Is there something?
Yeah. I'm in the midst of that now.
Let's hear it.
Well, time will tell if I'm able to succeed, but I've embraced the opportunity to lead this really unusual literary center in a very unusual place for a literary center in Las Vegas, hosted by University of Nevada, Las Vegas. It's the full name is the Beverly Rogers Carol C. Harder Black Mountain Institute, and really one of the most interesting and promising literary centers in the world. And I've got a terrific staff and a very, you know, cool set of colleagues at the university and this amazing group of donors. And we want to connect literary writers to public life in a way that really, you know, shapes conversation around the world and emphasizing conversation across differences and across cultures. You know, it could not possibly be more relevant or exciting than in this political moment. And I'm also a writer, and I have, many essays and books that are in progress, and, you know, one big book I'm trying to finish, and another one I'm eager to begin when I finish that. So this sort of movement between a solitary practice as a writer and you know, the social dynamic as a leader is something I've always wanted, and it's not easy. And I know I'm going to be crushed if my writing life gets beaten down. And I also want to do this job really, really well. So I'm saying yes and very loudly in my head every day, and I'm also just looking at the hard reality of the way the world is constantly trying to shut that down and make you choose one or the other.
Yeah, the world likes to say no. It's a hard thing to avoid.
We have people like you, reminding us to go back to first principles and celebrating, encouraging it. That it's very interesting to me to hear you speak from the sort of like there is a way in which the kind of the improv, the mm-hmm. culture of improvisation is this sort of hot nerve of this. You probably know the work of Keith Sawyer, who studied improvisation. And I didn't spend a ton of time with that because, that was sort of, to the extent that social dynamics had been studied, this is what had been done. And I was looking to make this contribution around a focus on dyad. But it's certainly evident that that's like, that's sort of the molten lava mm-hmm. of this whole conversation. And you have a ton to teach people about how to be present and be engaged and own them, their own potential and be really humble and grateful, and to laugh and have fun. I mean, that's sort of, I am a depressive and, always want to emphasize the dark side that I think people won't look at. Mm-hmm. But the truth is that, underneath all of this is just this massive amount of joy and excitement. And one of the things that kept me going was the joy and excitement that I felt just encountering the work of the people I was writing about. Which we just wouldn't have if they hadn't related to each other so creatively.
And you can't have one without the other. There is no light without the dark, no dark without the light.
For sure.
Yeah, and it gets messy.
Yeah, absolutely. And no John without Paul. And
nope.
Anytime you try to set up that opposition, I mean, this is actually something I'm trying to write, because I'm trying to write a little statement about why literature matters in this context. I don't know when this will be broadcast, but we're talking less than a week after Trump's election. And, there are lots of things that literature can do around empathy, around representing subjective experience. But to me, like, my own passion is around literature and the arts and the way that it can represent complexity, and especially, the possibility of holding opposites as a singular truth. And I think that the epigraph of my whole writing life is the F. Scott Fitzgerald quote that, the test of a first-rate mind is whether it can hold two opposing concepts without cracking up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of the center of this whole conversation. And for people who sort of see, I thought it was all solitude, to look at relationships, and people who are sort of fully in this kind of social mode and don't recognize that they need to lean back into their own deep center to be able to make that move too, and really, hold those two things together, that we are primary individuals. And we're also a kind of, we also are ants. we are social creatures to an extent that would be shocking, to any solitary mind that actually looked at the evidence of it.
That's great. Josh Wolfshank, you can get his books. You can order them at shank.net. He's got articles on there. It's a terrific website. Thank you so much for taking time to be on Getting the Essay.
Oh, yeah. It's a great pleasure. Yeah. Really, really fun. I haven't talked about this stuff in quite a while. And it's really galvanizing to know that it reached you and to get to play with these ideas with you.
Love it. Thanks so much.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine.
This is Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. You can find us at WGNplus.com. You can stream us on the WGN Plus app, or you can find us on iTunes. See you next week.